Chapter 11. There, thus it happened that on this occasion I groped my way into my sitting room to find the candle, and came out to light it. What were my emotions when, underneath the staircase lamp, shining with wet, as if he had never been dry since our last meeting, stood the mysterious being whom I had encountered on the steamboat in the thunderstorm, 2 years before. His prediction rushed upon my mind, and I turned faint. I said I'd do it, apostrophe he observed, in a hollow voice, and I have done it. May I come in? Apostrophe, misguided creature, what have you done? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I returned. I'll let you know, apostrophe was his reply, if you'll let me in. Apostrophe, could it be murder that he had done? And had he been so successful that he wanted to do it again, at my expense? I hesitated. May I come in? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said he. I inclined my head, with as much presence of mind as I could command, and he followed me into my chambers. There, I saw that the lower part of his face was tied up in what is commonly called a belcher handkerchief. He slowly removed this bandage, and exposed to view a long dark beard, curling over his upper lip, twisting about the corners of his mouth, and hanging down upon his breast. What is this? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I exclaimed involuntarily, and what have you become? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I am the ghost of art. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said he. The effect of these words, slowly uttered in the thunderstorm at midnight, was appalling in the last degree. More dead than alive, I surveyed him in silence. The German taste came up, apostrophe said he, and threw me out of bread. I am ready for the taste now. Apostrophe, he made his beard a little jagged with his hands, folded his arms, and said, severity. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I shuddered. It was so severe. He made his beard flowing on his breast, and, leaning both hands on the staff of a carpet broom which Mrs. Parkins had left among my books, said, benevolence. Apostrophe, I stood transfixed. The change of sentiment was entirely in the beard. The man might have left his face alone, or had no face. The beard did everything. He lay down, on his back, on my table, and with that action of his head, threw up his beard at the chin. That's death. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said he. He got off my table, and, looking up at the ceiling, cocked his beard a little awry, at the same time making it stick out before him. Adoration, or a vow of vengeance, apostrophe, he observed. He turned his profile to me, making his upper lip very bulky with the upper part of his beard. Romantic character, apostrophe said he. He looked sideways out of his beard, as if it were an ivy bush. Jealousy, apostrophe said he. He gave it an ingenious twist in the air, and informed me that he was carousing. He made it shaggy with his fingers, and it was despair, lank and it was avarice. Tossed it all kinds of ways, and it was rage. The beard did everything. I am the ghost of art, apostrophe said he. 2 bob a day now, and more when it's longer. Hair's the true expression. There is no other. I said I'd grow it, and I've grown it, and it shall haunt you. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he may have tumbled downstairs in the dark, but he never walked down or ran down. I looked over the banisters, and I was alone with the thunder. Need I add more of my terrific fate? It has haunted me ever since. It glares upon me from the walls of the Royal Academy, except when Maclay subdues it to his genius. It fills my soul with terror at the British Institution. It lures young artists onto their destruction. Go where I will, the ghost of art, eternally working the passions in air, and expressing everything by beard, pursues me. The prediction is accomplished, and the victim has no rest. Out of town, sitting, on a bright September morning, among my books and papers at my open window on the cliff overhanging the sea beach, I have the sky and ocean framed before me like a beautiful picture. A beautiful picture, but with such movement in it, such changes of light upon the sails of ships and wake of steamboats, such dazzling gleams of silver far out at sea, such fresh touches on the crisp wave tops as they break, and roll towards me a picture with such music in the billowy rush upon the shingle, the blowing of morning wine through the corn sheaves, where the farmers' wagons are busy, the singing of the larks, and the distant voices of children at play such charms of sight and sound as all the galleries on earth can but poorly suggest. So dreamy is the murmur of the sea below my window, that I may have been here, for anything I know, 100 years. Not that I have grown old, for, daily on the neighboring downs and grassy hillsides, I find that I can still in reason walk any distance, jump over anything, and climb up anywhere. But, that the sound of the ocean seems to have become so customary to my musings, and other realities seem so, to have gone aboard ship and floated away over the horizon, that, for aught I will undertake to the contrary, I am the enchanted son of the king my father, shut up in a tower on the seashore, for protection against an old she-goblin who insisted on being my godmother, and who foresaw the fond wonderful creature, that I should get into a scrape before I was 21. I remember to have been in a city, my royal parents' dominions, I suppose, and apparently not long ago either, that was in the dreariest condition. The principal inhabitants had all been changed into old newspapers, and in that form were preserving their window blinds from dust, and wrapping all their smaller household gods in curl papers. I walked through gloomy streets, where every house was shut up and newspapered, and where my solitary footsteps echoed on the deserted pavements. In the public rides there were no carriages, no horses, no animated existence, but a few sleepy policemen, and a few adventurous boys taking advantage of the devastation, to swarm up the lamp posts. In the westward streets there was no traffic. In the westward shops, no business. The water patterns which the prentices had trickled out on the pavements early in the morning remained uneffaced by human feet. At the corners of mews, cotch and china fowls stalked gaunt and savage, nobody being left in the deserted city, as it appeared to me, to feed them. Public houses, where splendid footmen swinging their legs over gorgeous hammer cloths beside wigged coachmen, were wont to regale, were silent, and the unused pewter pots shone, too bright for business, on the shelves. I beheld a Punch's show leaning against a wall near Park Lane, as if it had fainted. It was deserted, and there were none to heed its desolation. In Belgrave Square I met the last man an ostler sitting on a post in a ragged red waistcoat, eating straw, and mildewing away. If I recollect the name of the little town, on whose shore the sea is murmuring, but I am not just now, as I have premised, to be relied upon for anything, it is Pavilionstone. Within a quarter of a century, it was a little fishing town, and they do say, that the time was, when it was a little smuggling town. I have heard, that it was rather famous in the Hollands and Brandy way, and that coevally with that reputation the lamplighters was considered a bad life at the assurance offices. It was observed, that if he were not particular about lighting up, he lived in peace, but that, if he made the best of the oil lamps in the steep and narrow streets, he usually fell over the cliff at an early age. Now, gas and electricity run to the very water's edge, and the Southeastern Railway Company screech at us in the dead of night. But, the old little fishing and smuggling town remains, and is so tempting a place for the latter purpose, that I think of going out some night next week, in a fur cap and a pair of petticoat trousers, and running an empty tub, as a kind of archaeological pursuit. Let nobody with corns come to Pavilionstone, for there are breakneck flights of ragged steps, connecting the principal streets by back ways, which will cripple that visitor in half an hour. These are the ways by which, when I run that tub, I shall escape. I shall make a thermopylae of the corner of one of them, defend it with my cutlass against the coast guard until my brave companions have sheered off, then dive into the darkness, and regain my Susan's arms. In connection with these breakneck steps, I observed some wooden cottages, with tumble-down outhouses, and backyards 3 feet square, adorned with garlands of dried fish, in one of which, though the General Board of Health might object, my Susan dwells. The Southeastern Company have brought pavilion stone into such vogue, with their tidal trains and splendid steam packets, that a new pavilion stone is rising up. I am, myself, of new pavilion stone. We are a little mortary and limey at present, but we are getting on capitally. Indeed, we were getting on so fast, at one time, that we rather overdid it, and built a street of shops, the business of which may be expected to arrive in about 10 years. We are sensibly laid out in general, and with a little care and pains by no means wanting, so far, shall become a very pretty place. We ought to be, for our situation is delightful, our air is delicious, and our breezy hills and downs, carpeted with wild thyme, and decorated with millions of wild flowers, are, on the faith of a pedestrian, perfect. In New Pavilion Stone we are a little too much addicted to small windows with more bricks in them than glass, and we are not over fanciful in the way of decorative architecture, and we get unexpected sea views through cracks in the street doors. On the whole, however, we are very snug and comfortable, and well accommodated. But the Home Secretary, if there be such an officer, cannot too soon shut up the burial ground of the old parish church. It is in the midst of us, and Pavilion Stone will get no good of it, if it be too long left alone. The Lion of Pavilion Stone is its great hotel. A dozen years ago, going over to Paris by southeastern tidal steamer, you used to be dropped upon the platform of the main line Pavilion Stone station, not a junction then, at 11 o'clock on a dark winter's night, in a roaring wind. And in the howling wilderness outside the station, was a short omnibus which brought you up by the forehead the instant you got in at the door, and nobody cared about you, and you were alone in the world. You bumped over infinite chalk, until you were turned out at a strange building which had just left off being a barn without having quite begun to be a house, where nobody expected your coming, or knew what to do with you when you were come, and where you were usually blown about, until you happened to be blown against the cold beef, and finally into bed. At 5 in the morning you were blown out of bed, and after a dreary breakfast, with crumpled company, in the midst of confusion, were hustled on board a steamboat, and lay wretched on deck until you saw France lunging and surging at you with great vehemence over the bowsprit. Now, you come down to Pavilion Stone in a free and easy manner, and your responsible agent, made over in trust to the Southeastern Company, until you get out of the railway carriage at high water mark. If you are crossing by the boat at once, you have nothing to do but walk on board, and be happy there, if you can. I can't. If you are going to our great Pavilion Stone Hotel, the sprightliest porters under the sun, whose cheerful looks are a pleasant welcome, shoulder your luggage, drive it off in vans, bowl it away in trucks, and enjoy themselves in playing athletic games with it. If you are for public life at our great Pavilion Stone Hotel, you walk into that establishment, as if it were your club, and find ready for you, your newsroom, dining room, smoking room, billiard room, music room, public breakfast, public dinner twice a day, one plain, one gorgeous, hot baths and cold baths. If you want to be bored, there are plenty of bores always ready for you, and from Saturday to Monday in particular, you can be bored, if you like it, through and through. Should you want to be private at our great Pavilion Stone Hotel, say but the word, look at the list of charges. Choose your floor, name your figure, there you are, established in your castle, by the day, week, month, or year, innocent of all comers or goers, unless you have my fancy for walking early in the morning down the groves of boots and shoes, which so regularly flourish at all the chamber doors before breakfast, that it seems to me, as if nobody ever got up, or took them in. Are you going across the Alps, and would you like to air your Italian at our great Pavilion Stone Hotel? Talk to the manager, always conversational, accomplished, and polite. Do you want to be aided, abetted, comforted, or advised, at our great Pavilion Stone Hotel. Send for the good landlord, and he is your friend. Should you, or anyone belonging to you, ever be taken ill at our great Pavilion Stone Hotel, you will not soon forget him, or his kind wife. And when you pay your bill at our great Pavilion Stone Hotel, you will not be put out of humor by anything you find in it. A thoroughly good inn, in the days of coaching and posting, was a noble place. But no such inn would have been equal to the reception of 400 or 500 people, all of them wet through, and half of them dead sick, every day in the year. This is where we shine, in our Pavilion Stone Hotel. Again who, coming and going, pitching, and tossing, boating, and training, hurrying in, and flying out, could ever have calculated the fees, to be paid at an old-fashioned house? In our Pavilion Stone Hotel vocabulary, there is no such word as fee. Everything is done for you. Every service is provided at a fixed and reasonable charge. All the prices are hung up in all the rooms, and you can make out your own bill beforehand, as well as the bookkeeper. In the case of your being a pictorial artist, desirous of studying at small expense the physiognomies and beards of different nations, come, on receipt of this, to Pavilion Stone. You shall find all the nations of the earth, and all the styles of shaving and not shaving, hair cutting and hair letting alone, forever flowing through our hotel. Couriers you shall see by hundreds, fat leathern backs for 5-franc pieces, closing with violent snaps, like discharges of firearms, by thousands. More luggage in the morning than, 50 years ago, all Europe saw in a week. Looking at trains, steamboats, sick travelers, and luggage, is our great Pavilion Stone recreation. We are not strong in other public amusements. We have a literary and scientific institution, and we have a working men's institution. May it hold many gypsy holidays in Summerfields, with the kettle boiling, the band of music playing, and the people dancing, and may I be on the hillside, looking on with pleasure at a wholesome sight too rare in England. And we have 2 or 3 churches, and more chapels than I have yet added up. But public amusements are scarce with us. If a poor theatrical manager comes with his company to give us, in a loft, Mary Backs, or the murder on the sand hills, we don't care much for him, starve him out. In fact, we take more kindly to wax work, especially if it moves, in which case it keeps much clearer of the second commandment, than when it is still. Cook's Circus. Mr. Cook is my friend, and always leaves a good name behind him, gives us only a night in passing through. Nor does the traveling menagerie think us worth a longer visit. It gave us a look in the other day, bringing with it the residentiary van with the stained Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.